Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, once again, what I'm going to do is answer some of the emails that I get. And once again, I get hundreds of emails, and there's no way I can possibly answer all of them. So I like to answer some of them in groups, starting off with the polar vortex. The Northeast is frozen solid, they say, and it's all due to the polar vortex. Well, what is the polar vortex, and what does it have to do with global warming? And a few weeks ago, I did my own analysis. I gave my 2 cents worth concerning what I thought was the reason why Donald Trump won the presidential election. And I got quite a bit of feedback. Some people said, no. Some of the things I said were incorrect. So I'll try to answer some of the criticisms that came in concerning my analysis of Donald Trump's victory. And also, cancer is in the news. First of all, there's a new form of cancer that we've been talking about on Exploration for years, and that is immunotherapy. And now it's finally beginning to hit the mainstream press. And yes, there is an alternative to chemotherapy called immunotherapy, but there are also pluses and minuses with regards to immunotherapy. Not to mention that liquid biopsies are common, meaning that perhaps one day the word tumor will disappear from the English language. And there are also some mysteries with regards to cancer as well. It turns out that when scientists analyzed 10,000 women, they found that women with more social networks had less chance of dying and getting breast cancer. What a strange relationship. Once again, women with more social networks that are more sociable, married, have a large circle of friends, they survive breast cancer and they have less chance of dying of breast cancer and less chance of getting it. What's the reason behind that? And then we're going to say a few things about outer space. A lot of listeners wanted to know, what's the latest in terms of exploring Mars? Well, Elon Musk, the founder of SpaceX, finally laid out a detailed plan for the eventual colonization of the Red Planet and the creation of the first million people city on the Red Planet. And then we also have a question concerning my specialization, string theory. Some people ask the simple question, when are we going to be able to test string theory? Is it just a theory that just sits there untestable for generations? Or one day, will we be able to test the leading candidate for a theory of everything? Well, let's just jump right into some of the top stories of the past week. First of all, the polar vortex is on a lot of people's lips, especially if you're from the Chicago area, especially if your flight has been canceled, as literally thousands of flights have been canceled because of the freezing weather brought on by the polar vortex. First of all, is the polar vortex new? And the answer is no. It's been around even before humans walked the surface of the Earth. It's basically a gigantic hurricane on the North Pole. Usually it's stable. Usually the walls of the hurricane are quite sturdy, preventing cold air from inside the hurricane leaking outside. Now it turns out that the greater the difference in temperature between inside and outside, the stronger the walls are and the more stable the polar vortex is. But recently, and this is what's causing all the headlines, recently the polar vortex has been unstable, wobbling, breaking off pieces, and wandering in different directions, creating havoc in different areas when there should not be such freezing rain. And the question is, what is causing this instability in the polar vortex? Well, as I mentioned, the stability of the polar vortex is greater when the difference in temperature between the inside and the outside is the largest. That's because the winds blow at a fantastic rate, causing a low pressure area in the inside, and it makes for a very stable configuration. Now, the polar vortex becomes unstable if the center of the vortex begins to heat up, meaning that the temperature difference between the inside and the outside is lessened, causing the polar vortex to wobble, to break apart, and pieces are breaking apart even as we speak. So what's happening with global warming? Well, the polar ice caps are melting. First of all, the thickness of the polar ice caps in the North Pole has decreased by 50% over the last 50 years. That's a decline in the thickness of the sea ice at the rate of 1% per year, which is, in some sense, catastrophic. Not to mention the fact that satellite photographs of the polar regions show that the ice caps have decreased in size by twice the area of Alaska. Think of Alaska, multiply by two, and that's the amount of ice cover that's been lost in the North and Southern polar regions. Now, because the North Pole and the South Pole are heating up, it has consequences. As the center of the polar vortex heats up, the difference between the inside and the outside lessens, weakening the walls of the polar vortex, causing it to wander. Now, is that the only effect? Maybe not. Climatologists are still debating exactly what's causing it. Maybe El Nino has something to do with it, but at least one theory that is gaining a fair amount of credibility is the fact that as the center of the North Pole continues to heat up, the difference in temperature between the inside and the outside lessens as a consequence, meaning that the walls become unstable, meaning that the polar vortex begins to slowly crack apart and fission. So it's not a done deal. Not all climatologists buy into this theory. Some people say we need more data. We need more information. But that's one theory that's now being seriously considered, that it is global warming that is one of the main drivers of the instability of the polar vortex, which is in turn causing the freaky weather that's hitting the Northeast. And also a few weeks ago, I gave my 2 cents worth concerning the victory of Donald Trump. And I've gotten some feedback, which I'd like to share with you today. Basically, my point of view is, well, many theories have been proposed. Some people say it's racism. Some people say it's the coming of fascism. Other people say that it's the revenge of the white working class. Other people say, well, lots of things. However, one thing that is rarely mentioned, which I think is one of the main contributing factors, is technology, the change in technology. And you have to look at this from a historic point of view. And as I pointed out, we've had 3 major waves of innovation and technology. The first wave was the coming of steam power, which made possible the locomotive. And all of a sudden, we had factories mass-producing goods and services. The Industrial Revolution was now in full play with the coming of steam power. And I mentioned that that had a consequence. The social consequence was the creation of the working class. We forget that there really was no industrial working class centuries and centuries ago. The working class developed as we entered the Industrial Revolution. That's the first wave. The second wave was the coming of the electric revolution and also the internal combustion engine, in other words, the automobile. With the coming of electricity and the automobile, we had gigantic unions being formed, for example, in Detroit, and that became one of the main features of the labor movement, the creation of gigantic unions like the AFL-CIO, which was a byproduct of the second wave, electricity and magnetism and the internal combustion engine. The third wave is now, and that is high tech. And high tech means that with Moore's Law, computer power doubles every 18 months, and that's causing a lot of turmoil in the marketplace. The job market is changing as a consequence. We said that the first revolution helped to create the working class. The second revolution helped to spawn gigantic unions, which dominated the whole labor scene. And the third wave, the coming of high tech, is weakening the working class, strengthening the service sector, and also globalization is changing the nature of the job market. And we can see the coming of the fourth wave. The fourth wave, we think, will be a combination of artificial intelligence, biotech, and nanotech. Well, I got several emails coming in, and one of the emails says, now, wait a minute. Unions, some of the unions were formed during the first wave. That is, you go back to the beginnings of capitalism, and we see the beginnings of union. Yes, 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 I know that. However, what I'm talking about is the arrival of the gigantic unions, which then dominated the entire working class scene. And that didn't happen until the arrival of the electric revolution and the automobile revolution. We see the huge, gigantic unions coming out of Detroit, which changed everything. In fact, created what is called the Roosevelt Coalition. The Roosevelt Coalition, which dominated the Democratic Party, consisted of A, industrialized union workers, B, African Americans, and C, city dwellers and intellectuals. And so one person says, well, we've had unions since the beginning of capitalism. Yes, but they weren't the dominant feature of the working class. Another person wrote in and says, now, wait a minute. What are you saying about the future? Is the future going to be all computer programmers? If the third revolution is high tech and we're going into the fourth revolution of artificial intelligence, does that mean that everyone has to be a programmer and everyone has to be a high tech STEM person? And the answer is no. In other words, my positive program is, first of all, education. We do have to raise the level of the working class so that they can join in and work in a globalized world. We have to upgrade their skills. And second of all, if you read my book, Physics of the Future, I lay out all sorts of jobs that robots cannot do effectively. Robots cannot be gardeners. They cannot be construction workers. They cannot be policemen, because every crime is different. Every piece of garbage is different. Every plant is different. So non-repetitive, semi-skilled labor cannot be replaced by robots in the foreseeable future. For example, we have yet to have a robot that can clean up the mess at Fukushima. No robot on the earth can sweep the floor, turn valves, operate a car, and begin the cleanup operation at Fukushima. The Pentagon even sponsored a multi-million-dollar contest, and only one entry just barely made it across the finish line, and that robot came from Korea. So in other words, not everyone has to be a computer programmer in the future, but the education level of our students has to increase. We have to encourage governments funding basic research and science rather than cutting the science budget, because science is the engine of prosperity. Politicians think that wealth is a zero-sum game because you basically tax Peter to pay Paul. Well, that's a zero-sum game. That's like getting a pie and cutting it thinner and thinner and thinner and giving the pieces out to different people depending upon who votes for you. That's what politicians do. I'm a physicist. We believe in creating a bigger pie because science is the engine of prosperity. From the transistor to the computer to the laser to television to radio, microwaves, radar to X-rays to MRI scans to the space program and GPS, all of that was pioneered by physicists, creating a huge job market. And personally, I think that in the future, the robotics industry will be bigger than the automobile industry of today. Think about how big the automobile industry is today. It's going to be even bigger once we have a mature robotics industry. We need people to repair robots, to maintain them, to design them, to decommission them, to program them. Yes, a huge industry. And just remember that the automobile of the future will become a robot. You'll talk to it. You'll probably even argue with it. It'll park itself. You'll tell it what to do, and it'll go off by its own and do what it's supposed to do. In other words, your car will be a robot. So the robotics industry will eat up the automobile industry. But does that mean that you have to be a computer programmer to have a job in the future? No. As I said before, non-repetitive, semi-skilled work, gardening, construction work, police work, cannot be done by a robot. Middle-class jobs, they have to worry if they do repetitive work, for example, selling stock. Stockbrokers have to give something new in addition to the ability to sell stock, and that is knowledge, insight. That is the inside dope, experience, talent, leadership. Robots can't do any of those things. And so if you read my book, Physics of the Future, I lay out all the jobs that are waiting for people to take. But it does mean that governments have to play a role. They have to encourage entrepreneurship to create new jobs, new companies that will employ people. The governments have to fund science because that's where the new breakthroughs are going to take place with each wave of innovation. and education. We have to raise the level of education. So once again, many factors contributed to Trump's victory. But one of the biggest factors, if you take a look at Brexit in England, you take a look at the chaos erupting in Europe, is because of the change in the nature of science. Every time science changed from steam power to electricity to high technology and computers, it changed the job market. And that's what's causing the Trump phenomenon. Also, Brexit and what's happening with populism in Europe. We're seeing a new economy, based on globalization, on computers and high technology, but it does not mean we have to leave people behind. Also, cancer is in the news. First of all, on exploration, we've done a number of programs on immunotherapy, and now it's finally begun to hit the mainstream media. What is immunotherapy? Immunotherapy is based on the idea, first of all, that we do have an immune system. An immune system that is not very good at capturing cancer cells. It's very good at capturing bacteria and other things. That's why we can survive in an ocean of bacteria. However, it's not good in terms of recognizing cancer. However, it's possible to strengthen the immune system. You can take, for example, blood out of your body, grow strengthened T cells and inject the fluid back in the body, or you can inject chemicals in the body which strengthen directly these immune cells to attack cancer. And initial results are rather astounding. So in the future, there may be more than one way to treat cancer. However, in all fairness, we should point out that there are side effects to immunotherapy. Sometimes immunotherapy energizes the cells so much that they attack normal cells in the process. These are autoimmune diseases. For example, arthritis is an autoimmune disease. So we have to control it. If we take the genie out of the bottle, we have to make sure that the genie doesn't kill the host as a consequence. But tell your doctor to investigate immunotherapy because it's the new therapy on the block. Also, liquid biopsies are in the news. As we said before on exploration, it's possible to analyze blood, analyze the proteins and enzymes that are associated with cancer, and give a diagnosis of cancer without having to have these messy biopsies and procedures in a hospital. In the future, you'll simply go to the bathroom, and the bathroom will be sensitive enough to have sensors that can detect cancer enzymes, genes, and proteins, and tell you that you have cancer growing in your body when it's only a few hundred cancerous cells in a colony, not tens of billions of cancer cells in a tumor. In other words, in the future, the word tumor could literally disappear from the English language because of the fact that when you go to the bathroom, your toilet will have a chip in it, a toilet with a chip in it, and that chip is sensitive enough to detect the presence of cancer proteins and enzymes and genes years before a tumor actually forms. This is amazing if you think about it. However, there's one last mystery with regards to cancer that is making the rounds. It turns out there's a new study done last week, analyzed about 10,000 women, and they looked at social networks and the risk of dying from breast cancer. And they found something rather unusual that's causing a certain amount of controversy. They found there's a direct correlation. The more social networks a woman has, the greater the chances of surviving breast cancer. The lower the number of social networks, the less chance of surviving breast cancer. Well, that's encouraging. But then the question is, why? Why is it? Well, scientists have some theories that are being kicked around, but no definitive answer. So we really don't know. Is it a cause and effect? Maybe the people who are very social have a better immune system and therefore have less cancer. Or maybe it's just a coincidence that the two things occur at the same time. We don't really know for sure. Also, speaking about cancer, there's been a lot of controversy about the diet. Is a high-fat diet bad for cancer? A few months ago, I was looking at the magazines in the magazine shop, and there was a cover article that said, eat butter. Now, of course, that would be heretical just a few years ago, but the heretics may be taking over because there's a new way of looking at butter that maybe it doesn't really pack the pounds as much as you once thought. However, there's a word of caution. Forget about gaining weight. Let's take a look at dying. Let's take a look at cancer. It turns out a new study shows that a high-fat diet makes cancer spread much faster. High fats have a certain protein in it which accelerate the spread of cancer. So just when you thought that butter is safe, just when you thought that you can gorge yourself on a high-fat diet, beware, because we also know that high-fat diet accelerates the spread of cancer. Also, Mars is in the news. As I mentioned earlier, there may be a traffic jam around Mars in the coming decades because not one, not two, but three groups have stated that they are going to go to Mars, not just with a rocket ship, but with people on board. First, you have NASA. Second, you have Elon Musk and SpaceX. And third, you have Boeing. All three have said that, yes, a manned mission to Mars is their goal. Well, some people were skeptical of Elon Musk because, of course, NASA is governed by a bureaucracy. It has to release position papers. So we know a fair amount about what NASA is proposing. But with Elon Musk, SpaceX, it's a private corporation, and we really don't know. However, now we're beginning to get more and more information from NASA and Elon Musk. First of all, NASA thinks it's going to back a three-pronged process to go to Mars. In stage one, they're going to test a booster rocket called the SLS, as well as the Orion space module. And stage one is nothing but testing the booster rocket and the space module. Step two, they're actually going to fire the whole system and go to the moon. That's right, we're going to go back to the moon on the SLS, and perhaps even intercept an asteroid and bring back an asteroid. So in stage two, we're going to go back to the moon and perhaps lasso an asteroid in outer space so that it orbits the moon so we can mine it and study it at leisure. That's step two. Step three is when we actually send a piloted mission to the red planet sometime in the 2030s. Now, that's NASA's plan. However, Elon Musk, after dodging questions, has finally come out with his plan, and boy, is it ambitious. First of all, we're talking about a new booster rocket, not the SLS, but a new booster rocket, a modification of the Falcon rocket pioneered by SpaceX. This new booster rocket is called the ITS. It can carry twice the payload of the old Saturn rocket, which went to the moon. So we're talking about a rocket bigger than the Saturn rocket. And it's going to be very fast. It's going to have supercharged engines, which will take us to Mars in 80 days. Now, that's remarkable. First of all, when we send a probe to the moon every 26 months, it takes 9 months. 9 months for a probe to go from the Earth to Mars. Now, Elon Musk is saying, no. 80 days. And 80 days is a one-way trip from the Earth to Mars. And eventually, he's going to get down to 30 days. That's amazing if he can do that. Second of all, the SLS and the Orion module, we're talking about maybe, three or so people going to Mars. Nope. Elon Musk wants to think big. His rocket, he wants to have 100 to 200 people. Amazing. 100 to 200 people. And how many ships? 1,000 ships. And what's the goal? Get this. The goal is to create a city of 1 million people on Mars. Talk about thinking big. And then, of course, the killer question, cost. What is it going to cost to send 1 million people to Mars? Well, first of all, he's very clear to say that it's just not him. It's private and public funds put together. In other words, he will be asking the taxpayer to subsidize it, and a cost of $10 billion. $10 billion is what it would cost to build his system. And how much will each passenger pay? We're not talking about astronauts anymore. We're talking about an average person that is healthy enough to go to Mars. How much? $200,000 per passenger. Wow. In fact, he wants to get it down eventually to $100,000 per passenger. That is incredible. You realize that if you want to go up on Spaceship Two, you simply go up 70 miles, come down 70 miles, and that's it. You don't even orbit around the Earth. And how much do you pay? $200,000. What Elon Musk is saying for $200,000, forget about going up and coming down. Forget about going to the moon. We're talking about going to Mars. Mars at $200,000 per passenger. Now, the skeptics will say, well, all this sounds good, but what's your ace in the hole? I mean, how are you going to do this? Well, he has an ace up his sleeve. SpaceX has pioneered the reusable booster rocket. It takes off like a rocket, disengages from the higher stages, and then goes back down again, back to the planet Earth, and lands on a launch pad all by itself. That's how he expects to reduce costs, by having reusable rockets. Rockets that can be fired over and over again. This also means, because he has so much experience landing with rockets, that he wants to test a new way of landing on Mars. That's right. In 2018, in 2 years, 2 years' time, he wants to send the first unmanned rocket to Mars, and it's going to land on Mars just the way they do it in science fiction. In science fiction, the rocket enters the atmosphere, goes up, and then gently comes back down again. That's how they do it in science fiction, but never on an Earth-bound rocket ship. It's simply too complicated. Well, that's what Elon Musk wants to do. He wants to enter the Martian atmosphere, have the rocket take over its own trajectory, and then flip over and land the way a rocket should land. Well, all of this sounds amazing, but of course, the proof is in the pudding. The question is, can he pull it off, even with $10 billion? Remember that the earlier estimates of a manned mission to Mars were up to several hundred billion dollars. He wants to cut the cost by a factor of 10. Is that really possible? Well, we'll have to wait and see. But never discount the fortitude and determination of Elon Musk. Well, that completes the first part of Exploration. In the second part of Exploration, we'll continue our discussion of automation and jobs by bringing on Ray Kurzweil, futurist, author of the book, The Singularity is Coming, and we'll talk about the future of robots, the future of artificial intelligence. How will humans interact with robots into the future, and what will that do to the job market? What will that do to our way of life? And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. So stay tuned for the second half of Exploration. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we encountered a number of topics in science, including a scientific investigation of the social forces behind Donald Trump. And my personal point of view is that, well, yes, racism and bigotry and all that kind of stuff did play a role, but the decisive factor was not that. The decisive factor was the changing of capitalism itself as we enter the third and the fourth wave of scientific innovation and job creation. Science is the engine of prosperity, but science doesn't wait, and it's creating losers and winners. And many of the losers decided to vote this time around, and that sent shockwaves throughout England, shockwaves throughout Europe, and of course, shockwaves here in the United States. So we're talking about a change in the way in which jobs are created, and that's because science doesn't wait for anyone. We're entering the third and fourth eras of scientific innovation and job creation. And in the second half of Exploration, we're going to bring on inventor Ray Kurzweil, author of a number of bestsellers, including The Age of Spiritual Machines and The Singularity is Near. And his thesis is a controversial one. It's a minority opinion, but it's an opinion that has to be heard. And his claim is that very soon, perhaps by 2020, perhaps very soon, machines will begin to approach human intelligence, and perhaps even exceed human intelligence. And even worse than this for humans, robots will be able to create copies of themselves that are even more intelligent than they are. And so they'll be able to bootstrap themselves to become arbitrarily intelligent, in which case they may begin to leave the Earth and begin to colonize the galaxy. That is called the singularity, the point at which we have runaway machines creating machines of even higher intelligence, and the whole process just keeps on going until they, well, take over the universe. Sounds like science fiction? Well, yeah, but it's a position that can't be ruled out. So once again, our special guest in the second half of Exploration is inventor Ray Kurzweil, and we are talking about, well, what happens when the computer revolution goes amok. Mr. Kurzweil, the first question for you is, how did you first get interested in robots and artificial intelligence?
I've actually had in mind being an inventor since I was at the age of 5. And age of 12, I discovered computers. I built some primitive computers myself and got access to one as part of a summer job, and quickly became fascinated with the ability to kind of model the world, albeit primitively at that time, in the computer and create virtual realities, and also model our thinking processes. Quickly became interested, actually, in pattern recognition, which, it's my view, is the fundamental basis of human intelligence rather than logical, sequential, analytical thinking. And a project I did in high school was to build pattern recognition models of melodies, and I would feed in the melodies of Mozart or Chopin, and it would build a pattern recognition model and then write original melodies in the same style from that model, which were recognizable, kind of sounded like second-rate compositions from a second-rate student of Chopin and Mozart. And that started really a lifelong fascination in pattern recognition, which is really my primary technical field.
Okay, and let's talk about your book, The Age of Spiritual Machines. First of all, what is a spiritual machine? Is that a contradiction in terms?
The primary concept of spirituality is really consciousness. If we consider a being or an entity to be conscious, then we consider it to have spiritual value. And if you look at all the different religious traditions, what they really mean by a soul and by spiritual reality is consciousness, an entity that really has subjective experience and can feel pain and joy, as opposed to just the conventional concept of a machine, which is operating by some kind of automatic process. And we don't worry much today about causing pain and suffering to our computer programs. But our computer software is still millions of times simpler than the human brain. We do find, if we look at the human brain, that we actually can model it with great precision neurons and even substantial clusters of neurons. We can talk more about that. And we will have machines, which is to say non-biological entities, that do have the complexity and richness and depth of the human brain, indeed modeled on the principles of operation of the human brain within a few decades. And when these entities claim to be conscious, to be joyful, fearful, angry, and so on, unlike, let's say, the computer characters in video games today, those entities, a few decades from now, will be as convincing as humans. They'll have all the subtle emotional cues that we associate with somebody really having those subjective experiences. So are they conscious? Some philosophers will say, no, they're not squirting human neurotransmitters. You can't be conscious if you're not biological. But there won't be any clear distinction. We won't be able to separate them from any kind of objective observation. And my prediction, and this is really not a philosophical statement, but a psychological and political prediction, is that the bulk of humans, unenhanced humans, will consider these non-biological entities to be conscious. In any event, they'll be very intelligent, they'll be able to convince us that they're conscious, and they'll get angry at us if we don't believe them. And it'll be an actual political and legal issue as well. In my view, the real issue of consciousness is not something we can resolve scientifically, because science involves third-party objective observation. Consciousness is inherently first-party subjective experience, and there is a gap there. Some people go on to say, well, since it's not scientific, it's not an important question. I would turn that around and say it's really a very fundamental question. It shows that there is a need for philosophy outside of science. But these will become real compelling questions as opposed to just abstract philosophical debates in this 21st century.
Okay, and let's talk about the past first as a guide to the future. Back in the 1950s and 60s, there were dazzling breakthroughs in artificial intelligence theory. We had the first machines, for example, that could play chess and checkers, not very well, but they could at least play the game. They could solve simple algebra theorems. They could even play doctor to a degree and do simple diagnoses. And there were all these fantastic predictions that just within a few years, humans will be put in a zoo, we'll all be zoo animals, and our creations will throw peanuts at us and make us dance behind bars because look at how fast computers are learning. And then there was the movie 2001, and, well, the year 2001 came and went, and we still do not have the robot Hal, the murderous robot in Arthur C. Clarke's famous movie that could pilot a spaceship, could play chess, and interact with humans as if it was a human itself. So the question is, what happened to the dream of the 1950s and 60s when everyone was predicting that humans would be obsolete by the 1970s?
Well, your observation is correct. I would say wasn't everyone predicting that. There were some famous predictions from Simon and Newell at Carnegie Mellon, which came into disrepute. But there was over-optimism because machines were doing adult activities, like solving some unsolved theorems from Russell and Whitehead and doing these adult activities, playing chess, in some narrow cases, making medical diagnoses as well as doctors and so on. So it seemed it wouldn't be long before a computer could do everything. Another 10 years went by, and we realized that computers, while they were able to do these sort of high-level analytic tasks, were not able to do some things that a four-year-old can do, which is, let's say, tell the difference between a dog and a cat or recognize faces. And this is really a fundamental issue, in my view, that the fundamental basis of human intelligence is not analytic, logical thinking. And in fact, machines can do that a lot better than humans in most cases. The fundamental basis of human intelligence is pattern recognition. We can see that in the contrast with how machines play chess, which is this minimax combinatorial expansion of move counter moves, which it does largely through brute force. We can look at millions or even hundreds of millions of board positions in a second. Kasparov says he looks at less than one board position in a second, but humans use their tremendous powers of pattern recognition to recognize situations they've thought about before. And we don't think fast enough. Our inner neuronal connections compute 200 calculations per second, which is about 10 to 100 million times slower than electronic circuits, but we have 100 trillion of them, all computing simultaneously, self-organizing. Information is really represented as a pattern. No key connection is all that important. It's a very different paradigm from computers we're used to, and it's a very good architecture for recognizing patterns in a profound way. That is really the heart of human intelligence. Now, we have been making steady progress in pattern recognition. I could give many examples of that, both in terms of recognizing language and speech. Character recognition have all improved gradually. Even in chess, machines have become better qualitative players, so you have Deep Fritz and the current programs working actually as well as Deep Blue, despite the fact that they're about 100 times slower, that they're doing a better job of pattern recognition. So we are making steady progress on that, and that is really the key issue now. And part of the guidance we'll get in terms of creating the templates of pattern, human-level pattern recognition is to actually understand how humans do it, which brings up the issue of reverse engineering the human brain. It wasn't long ago before people were saying, well, you know, our intelligence is just below the level necessary to actually understand our own intelligence. But what we're finding is that as we're able to actually instrument the brain and see what's going on, and our ability to scan the human brain and to actually see the connections and the firings of neuronal connections and synapses is increasing, actually doubling every year, we are able to develop very detailed mathematical models of neurons and neuron clusters. Lloyd Watts and his colleagues have actually created a reverse engineering of the whole acoustic area of the brain involving 12 different regions with a great deal of detail, have re-implemented that in software and submitted that to psychoacoustic tests, which performs very comparably to human auditory perception. If you follow all the exponential trends in computation, communication, brain scanning, exponentially growing knowledge of the human brain, it's, I think, conservative to say we will have reverse engineered the principles of operation of the human brain within a quarter century. And that will provide us, you know, more powerful, biologically inspired methods for pattern recognition.
Okay, well, we've had several AI specialists on the radio show before, among them Rodney Brooks of MIT, the director of the Artificial Intelligence Laboratory. And I asked him a key question, and that is, well, how powerful are the MIT robots? And he was very proud to say that he's the godfather of the Mars rover, an advanced robot which actually wandered on the surface of Mars. But he was honest and said that his most advanced robots have the intelligence of a cockroach. In fact, cockroaches do it a lot better, he said. Cockroaches can scope out environments, see obstacles, boulders, maneuver around them, and they're quite good at this. And robots at Carnegie Mellon and Stanford, well, when they walk down the hall, it's lucky if they don't gouge out a piece of the wallpaper when they walk down the hallway. So how smart are our robots? Are our robots really so dumb that they are really insect level at the present time, barely able to understand chairs, tables, the ceiling, the roof, people maneuvering around the room? How smart are the robots today?
Well, robots and artificial intelligence in general are operating far below biological levels, both in terms of hardware and software, and I think it's worthwhile talking about both of those, but also to understand that we're making exponential progress in both of these realms. And exponential progress really sneaks up on you. And just to use an analogy, Kasparov played the best machines in the 1990 at chess, and they were pathetic, and he scoffed at them. And it was just inconceivable that they would ever reach his level. But they gradually got better. They're doubling in performance every year, gaining 40 chess points every year, and chess scale is exponential. And then they surpassed him, operating at or beyond his level by 1997. We'll see the same thing in other areas. And it's easy to lose sight of tremendous power of exponential growth. We are doubling computation at least every year, and we'll We'll talk a little bit later about the issue of Moore's Law, but I believe that this phenomenon will continue past Moore's Law into three-dimensional computing. And in terms of software, we're making exponential progress, as I mentioned, in understanding and reverse engineering the principles of operation of the human brain. There's a new brain scanning method now that's being developed, which will be available within a couple of years. They will actually be able to see individual nerve fibers firing in a cluster of thousands of neurons at very high resolution, very high resolution also in terms of time scale, which will really give us the means to reverse engineer those circuits. I mean, so far, we've been really unable to see what's going on. It's very hard to diagnose a circuit if you can't instrument it. But if you can put sensors on in the right place and see what's going on, it's very straightforward to reverse engineer. The human brain, of course, is created by a genome that doesn't have very much information in it. Even though the human brain itself appears to contain thousands of trillions of bytes, the genome only has about 12 million bytes of information to characterize the initial design of the brain, because there's a lot of random wiring in the way it's actually constructed, which then self-organizes to reflect its experience with the world. So the principles of operation are of a complexity that we can't understand. And that will provide us at least biologically inspired paradigms for the software of intelligence. And so the capabilities of all of these systems will improve quite steadily, and we will master different levels of biological intelligence. Ultimately, I believe within less than three decades, by 2029, these machines will be operating at human levels and will combine human levels of intelligence, the subtlety and suppleness of human pattern recognition, with some of the natural advantages of machines, most notable of which is the ability to instantly share knowledge.
Now let's talk a little bit about Moore's Law, the doubling time you mentioned of 18 months for computers, meaning that at Christmas time, your computers are almost twice as powerful as they were the previous Christmas. Exponential growth in bacteria, for example, eventually seals off, otherwise bacteria would take over the entire planet Earth. And exponential factors do taper off because of external effects. Now, with Moore's Law and computers, the engine driving Moore's Law is ultraviolet etching technology, by which we can etch tinier and tinier transistors on a silicon wafer the size of your thumb. But eventually, the transistors get so tiny, you hit the quantum theory. And at that point, you get short circuits. Leakage takes place. All hell breaks loose. And by 2020, all bets are off. The Intel, one of the senior engineers at Intel, admitted recently in a major paper that, yes, they can see the end of the tunnel. And that is, at a certain point, it's going to be prohibitively difficult to etch silicon components that are tinier and tinier, and eventually you get leakage because you don't know where the electrons are. Some people have said, let's make three-dimensional cubes. But the problem there is you have heat generation, enormous quantities of heat generated in three-dimensional cubes. So the question is, what happens after 2020 when all hell breaks loose and Silicon Valley becomes a rust belt?
Well, it's a key question, and to examine that, I've done a number of things. I have been an ardent student of technology trends. I've been measuring the actual power of different technologies for 25 years. Have a team of people doing that. One thing I did is put 49 famous computers over the last century, long before there was a Moore's Law, on an exponential chart. And this exponential growth has been going on not just from Moore's Law, but back through five different paradigms. Moore's Law, the shrinking of transistors on a flat integrated circuit, was not the first, but the fifth paradigm to provide exponential growth to computing. And every time one paradigm ran out of steam, because as you correctly point out, every method of exponential growth eventually runs out of capacity. Rabbits in Australia eat up the vegetation and stop growing exponentially, even reverse direction. Every time that happened, another paradigm came along and started another S-curve of exponential growth. They were shrinking vacuum tubes to continue exponential growth. Finally, they couldn't shrink them anymore and keep the vacuum. That paradigm ended. Transistors came along. And the next paradigm will be three-dimensional. computing. We live in a three-dimensional world. Our brains are organized in three dimensions. Our brain, by the way, uses a very cumbersome, very slow electrochemical information processing method that's 200 calculations per second. They're digitally controlled analog transactions, but they're roughly comparable to calculations, at least 10 million times slower than electronic circuits. But it gets its tremendous power from the fact that it's organized in three dimensions. Now, the brain itself is an existence proof of the feasibility of organizing circuits in three dimensions and dealing with the heat problem. I proposed three-dimensional computing as the sixth paradigm to replace Moore's Law, which was the fifth paradigm in my book, The Age of Spiritual Machines, 4 years ago. It was considered a radical notion then. I would say it's much more of a mainstream expectation at this time. There's been tremendous progress in building working three-dimensional circuits over the last 4 years. There's been a steady flow of breakthroughs, including conceptual examinations of this thermal issue that you alluded to. And there are ways of designing the circuits in porous ways to deal with the heat issue. 1 watt of power, which would not generate that much heat, would be sufficient to emulate human brain capacity in a cube that would be very tiny. So the thermal issue is, in fact, a key challenge, but there's a lot of confidence that that's feasible. And we still have at least a dozen years to go. And what we've seen typically is when the end is in sight for a particular paradigm, it creates tremendous pressure in the R&D community to create the next paradigm. And we have a lot of advance warning this time. And already, in fact, just using conventional lithography and going to the third dimension, because after all, even conventional circuits have 14 or 15 layers of material, so they do have some three-dimensional capacity. And there's been successful efforts to build circuits with dozens and even up to 100 layers of circuitry just using conventional techniques. There are many different approaches. The most effective appears to be carbon nanotubes, which is what I had predicted in my book 4 years ago.
Okay. Well, the heat problem, as you mentioned, is quite fierce. Engineers tell me that very soon, even cubicle computers will generate so much heat you can fry an egg on them. Let me ask you a question about the top up, the top-down approach and the bottom-up approach. When we had Rodney Brooks on the radio, he said that there are two approaches to artificial intelligence, top-down and bottom-up. The top-down approach has dominated AI research for the last several decades, and the goal there is to have a CD-ROM with all the laws of common sense, all the laws of logic on it. You simply put the CD-ROM in a computer, and all of a sudden your computer says, I think, I am aware, I am conscious, okay, I'm alive. That's the top-down approach, which failed rather miserably. We know that there are hundreds of millions of lines of common sense. We can't put them on a CD-ROM. There's so many of them. The other one is the bottom-up approach, which follows nature, Mother Nature, allowing machines to learn like bugs, like infants, to bump into the environment. And that approach is like a neural network approach. So could you explain to us a little bit about neural network theory? And this, of course, means that our brain, in some sense, is not really a digital computer at all, that perhaps we were sort of misled over the last 50 years in terms of the successes of silicon, but the brain is really a neural network and not really a Turing machine at all. Could you elaborate?
Well, I've always been a strong advocate of what you're referring to as the bottom-up approach. As I mentioned earlier, the brain, the design of it, is characterized by only about 12 million bytes of compressed information in the genome. You might wonder, how could that be when the brain itself contains millions of times more information than that? And the way it works is the genome specifies a particular design, but in a particular region, the actual wiring of the connection is random within certain constraints. And we know that that's the case, having watched how that process unfolds. Then there's actually kind of an evolutionary process where the connections that make the most sense in the environment survive, and it's actually twice as many connections in the newborn baby's brain as exists a year later. There's a lot of self-organization, and the brain has the capacity to interact with its environment, make sense of the environment, as well as make sense of its own design, and its own interconnections actually continually being repruned and reconnected to make sense of the environment and to learn. And that is really the only approach that's going to work. I think the Psyche Project of Doug Lanat is interesting. It's accomplished a lot, but I never felt that we could build human-level intelligence that way. We really have to build it the way nature builds it, which is a machine that has the capacity to learn, and then provide for its education. Now, neural nets is sort of one attempt based on a crude model of how human neurons work, which actually builds lots of neuron simulators and connects them somewhat the way the brain connects them and let them self-organize. And there's a number of different approaches to neural nets. They're all very simplified from what we now know is true of actual neurons. And as we're as progress in reverse engineering the human brain progresses and we have more sophisticated and realistic models of actual neurons, we can build more realistic, biologically inspired paradigms. But in general, pattern recognition, which is my field, works by emulating nature in these self-organizing methods. We set up some approach, which could be a neural net, this thing called Markov models, which is a mathematical cousin of neural nets. They're evolutionary algorithms that actually emulate evolution. And actually, part of human learning has a kind of an evolutionary process take place inside the brain, where the better connections that survive. And we use these techniques in our pattern recognition approach. We'll actually simulate evolution, have different solutions to a problem, compete with each other through thousands of generations of simulated evolution. And these biologically inspired methods are very powerful. They give results that are essentially unpredictable, just as sort of human decision-making is unpredictable without actually letting it unfold. And this is really the approach that will work, trying to define as analytic logical rules every bit of common sense, it's not going to work. It's too complex, too unwieldy, and it's not how human intelligence works.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, our special guest today was Ray Kurzweil, author of the book The Singularity Is Near. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. So once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College of New York, inviting you to join us every week when we discuss science and its impact on society. Good day.